Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. I'd like to welcome back Matt Forney.
Thanks for having me on the show again, Robert.
So we're going to be covering a number of different topics, but the one I want to focus especially on is your essay on managerialism. And we touched on this in our last interview.
Yeah, I brought it up there when I was talking about Mark Ames' Going Postal.
And he doesn't discuss managerialism in his book, but the context you brought it up in is that the system that we have, it's neither capitalist or socialist. The best description for it is managerialism.
Yes, exactly. The Managerial Revolution was a book written by James Burnham in 1940. It was Burnham was a former Trotskyist and a participant in the Fourth International, but who later became a neoconservative and a contributor to National Review in his later career. But this was written during his transitional period in 1940, and his observation was that capitalism was being replaced, as the Marxists said it would, but it was not being replaced with socialism. It was being replaced with a new system that he called managerialism, ruled by the managers, as opposed to the people, which is what Karl Marx had predicted and what the communists and the socialists were expecting.
Well, the thing about capitalism, what we have now is not capitalism in its true form. But the flaw of capitalism is that capitalism led to managerialism because it took away the limitations on wealth, and it let when you get rid of the limitations on unlimited wealth, that actually led to the managerial system.
That's part of it. And the other big reason why managerialism came along, as Burnham says, and I'm not sure if I got this point across, is, well, there's two big things. Number one was technological advances that make large-scale organization easier and also make it possible for governments to have a much tighter control over their citizenry than they did in the past. Like, Burnham uses examples such as, like, the telephone, which allows people to communicate across wide distances, the telephone, the telegraph, but at the same time, you can also have governments, you know, wiretapping people's phones and bugging their houses and whatnot. And look today, you know, it's like the wide-scale, you know, espionage done by the NSA and having their hooks into everything and what we're doing wouldn't be possible if it weren't for computers and the internet. And the other major thing that the other major reason why Burnham said capitalism was being replaced by managerialism and not socialism was because ruling these increasingly dense, increasingly populated countries like the U.S. or the Soviet Union or Germany or Britain or whatnot requires a skill set that most, like, proles do not, you know, happen. Marx did not possess. Marx was writing from an industrial standpoint, and when the economy was based on during the Industrial Revolution, you know, it was, you know, conceivable to say that at some point, you know, the proles, the proletarians, could at some point run that system. But as the world transitioned into the post-industrial era following World War I, the increasingly specialization of corporations and governments and whatnot required, say, you know, administrators, engineers, managers, CEOs, people who have more brain power and more, you know, learning and more credentials than the average proletarian. Basically, what he was saying, Burnham, was that the proles simply are not smart enough to lead society. We need we're getting a more intelligent, more credentialed class to do it, because they're the only people who can.
So basically, the public versus private dichotomy that liberals and conservatives fight over is totally false. They're both products of the same. They're both managerial systems. Where you have the corporate CEOs, the mid-level managers, the different types of government bureaucrats, the alphabet organizations that you mentioned, like the FBI and the CIA, they're all part of the managerial system.
Yes, Burnham's prediction was that as society became more managerialist, the structures of capitalist government and the structures of capitalist organization would either become obsolete or just be abolished entirely. And he based this based on the fact that capitalism had done the same thing to feudalism emerging in the Renaissance and the 14th century. the aristocracy that ruled over Europe during the Middle Ages was gradually either violently overthrown, as in the case of France, we had the French Revolution, or gradually, as we had in the case of England, where the king slowly lost power, and power shifted over to Parliament, which was dominated by the merchants, the capitalists. And right now we're seeing capitalist structures such as Congress and legislatures losing power to, number one, the executive branch, the president, who is basically a managerial executive, and two, to these unaccountable alphabet agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA, FEMA, that sort of thing, who are not accountable to anyone but themselves. And these organizations function identically to actual private corporations. There's no demonstrable difference between them. It's just that one is government and the other is private, but basically they're all one big amalgamation of bureaucracy.
Yeah, because I mean the head of the FBI, for instance, he's not an elected official the way that, say, like a county sheriff would be.
Yes, elected officials are accountable to their voters. These people are not accountable to anyone, and they can basically do whatever they want. I mean, the Tea Party Republicans make a lot of noise about reducing the federal deficit and about cutting down bureaucracy, but whenever they take actionable steps to fight the bureaucracy, they are always rebuffed with huge amounts of force. Like when Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin tried to combat the state employees unions a couple years ago. He basically found himself become the most hated man in America. Massive shutdowns. The Democrats in the Wisconsin Senate fled the state to prevent him from obtaining a quorum. It's like they are the people who truly rule us, not the elected officials, but the bureaucracies.
The book is very. It's actually for being such a remarkable book. It's not even that it's that well known. What are some of the responses to the book? I know George Orwell is probably the most famous one.
The actual response essay he wrote is not that smart, but here's the thing. When he wrote 1984, about 3 or 4 years later, in many ways, 1984 presaged the... was about an extreme version of managerialism taken to extremes. It's like society is organized into the proles and the party, which is basically a gigantic bureaucracy that rules everything, and totalitarian systems such as the telescreen, thought police, which would have been inconceivable in prior epochs, are now possible with modern technology. And so that was sort of the irony of it. But the book has been more or less been kind of forgotten. It's been out of print for decades. If you go to like Amazon, old copies are going for like $40 a bit. There's no Kindle version. My copy I bought on eBay from a seller in the UK. I got it for about £10, which is really a bargain considering just how rare the book is. I have difficulty understanding why it's been so forgotten.
The book was a big influence on Sam Francis.
Yes. The book was influential in its day, but it's been forgotten by, modern theorists. Burnham is one of those types who sort of, he survives not so much by his own writing, but by the fact that he's influenced writers who came out to be more popular than him, like Sam Francis.
And Burnham, I mean, he also observed that the Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany, and the U.S. under Roosevelt, they were all sort of adopting these parallel patterns.
Yes, the thing is that despite, being supposedly in practice diametrically opposed to each other, at the basic level, the Soviet Union, the Nazi Germany, and the United States under Roosevelt were all organized in the same fashion. The Soviet Union had, under Stalin, had pretty much given up the idea of the proletarian revolution and had adopted a sort of, what was called the nomenklatura, which was the arrayment of bureaucrats and petty, chieftains who were promoted under Communist Party rule and were given executive positions over just about everything. Hitler was, despite being, Hitler is considered right-wing, he was a fierce opponent of the old German aristocracy. He hated reactionaries. He considered them one of his biggest enemies, and he created his own, through the Nazi Party, he created his own patronage network that was diametrically opposed to the aristocrats such as von Hindenburg and whatnot. And under the U.S. we had what Burnham calls New Dealism, but could just as easily been grouped under the rubric of Keynesian economics, in which we were, which the government was creating make work programs that to employ people because the existing capitalist businesses and what could not. That was the thing. The government was stepping in to fix the problem of mass unemployment that capitalism could not solve.
And I guess one good example of that is the bank bailouts that you put out in your article.
That's a perfect example of how basically the managers rule all. If you want to crunch the numbers, the actual capitalists on Wall Street, the shareholders, the people who trade stock, they're the ones who lost the biggest. They pretty much universally lost in the bank bailouts. After the bank bailout, I believe it was Citi stock price cratered from, I think, about $40 a share to around $3 a share. But the managers, the CEOs, your Lloyd Blankfeins, you know, your John Corzines, people like that, they always get big pay raises. They never lose their jobs. Whenever they quit their jobs, they always get a golden parachute. And they find themselves going into government as Hank Paulson did, first as the CEO of Goldman Sachs and as the Treasury Secretary. John Corzine has gone from being an investment banker on Wall Street to governor of New Jersey to chair of MF Global, where he lost $1 billion, I mean, stole $1 billion of his customers' money and was not punished for it. These are the people who truly rule us, not the capitalists, but the managers, the CEOs. They are of the manager class.
And he also predicted in his book that we would see these sort of supranational entities like the European Union.
He didn't predict the European Union precisely.
He said that it would be the U.S., Germany, and Japan. But was this written? He didn't predict that those countries would be defeated.
Yes, like I said, the book was written in 1940, not long after France surrendered to Germany, and his outlook for the future was rather pessimistic. His theory was that Germany would overcome Russia due to superior organization and the fact, well, to a certain extent, it's a sort of old class Tory snobbery about how the Northern Europeans are infinitely superior, but Germany, and he also did not take into account, you know, as I would call it, Marx's human stupidity. He's still constrained to a certain extent. His analysis is constrained by a Marxist frame. He thought that when Hitler canceled Operation Sea Lion, the plan to invade Britain in the 40s, he thought that the reason why Germany was trying to make peace with Britain was because doing so would allow the Nazis to more easily take control of the British Empire, which at the time was being chipped away. Its outer fringes were being chipped away by other entities.
And the one thing about it is, it's not dissimilar. You could make an argument that, like capitalism, it is still, despite the managerial class, it's still a system that where wealth is concentrated among the very very elite, as opposed to spread among the masses.
Exactly. I mean, jumpstart the economy, and it helped to create the relative prosperity that America experienced in the late 40s and 50s. But right now, the system is sort of collapsing on itself, going absolutely nowhere. I mean, if you want to see an example of how managerialism is failing, well, it started off in Japan, which is still in a recession from the 80s. The Japanese government has done nothing but Keynesian economics of spending money and trying to employ people in make work organizations, and it's not working. The bank bailouts are not working. Unemployment is still high. Unofficial employment is probably a lot higher than what the official figures say. Underemployment is sky high. And as Burnham observes, high unemployment is always a sign that an economic system is nearing its end. The fact that the current managerial elite cannot solve the existing problems indicates that we're on the cusp of a great social change.
So you're not totally pessimistic in the sense that you see managerialism as being something permanent or long-term?
Well, as Burnham himself made the observation, capitalism was not permanent. Capitalism rose in the Renaissance and died around World War I. Managerialism rises, and it will have to fall too, because everything that has a beginning has an end. And I don't know what's going to replace it. I'm not psychic, but it's going to have to change one way or another. I mean, as like I said, maximum unemployment. The system is not going to be able to sustain itself indefinitely with the high levels of unemployment and the high levels of underemployment and the massive levels of unemployment. We're already seeing the emergence of a new social order in places like Greece and Spain, which are racked at like 50% unemployment, with the rise of organizations like Golden Dawn that are providing an alternative to the current managerial system. So it's only a matter of time before a alternative emerges in the U.S. and the U.K. I can't say that when exactly that will be, only to say that it will probably be soon.
The only thing that's unique about managerialism that the previous systems didn't have, it's the whole infrastructure and technology that's in place. That's the one thing that is unique about it that would make it more difficult to overthrow.
Your question got cut off there, sorry.
Okay, I was saying that the aspect of the technological aspect of managerialism, that is the one aspect that would make it more difficult to overthrow than previous systems, because I mean, they have this whole spy network that of all the information that's out there, and those previous systems, they didn't have that, and that could make managerialism more difficult to overthrow.
It does make it difficult on the surface, but we have to keep in mind that all systems are run by people, and people are fallible. I mean, looking at what's happened with Edward Snowden right there, following what happened with Snowden's leaks, the NSA and related organizations announced a clampdown, but what these clampdowns end up doing is that they end up making it more difficult for the NSA people to do their jobs. I mean, there's just so much information they have to sift through coming from on the internet that eventually they're going to slip, and eventually things are going to fall. I mean, nobody really could have predicted the fall of capitalism in World War I, it seems like we're up against something that's insurmountable, but everything is fallible at the end of the day. As long as humans are not angels, everything they create is going to fall apart at some point or another, and managerialism will go down just as every other economic system human beings have had has collapsed at some point.
Yeah, I mean, people took for granted that, communism was going to be something that's permanent.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just unbelievable how Marxists were so arrogant as to think that their system would automatically become dominant. The future is a lot more difficult to predict than most people think it is. And that's the current regime will fall. I don't know how, but it will fall. And I don't know what form it will take, but the end is inevitable. Everything that has a beginning has an end.
So the other one I'd like to focus on is, you have this article, it's a tribute to Emma Lazarus, give me you're hungry, you're tired, you're poor, and I'll piss on them.
that's actually a lyric from a song by Lou Reed called Dirty Boulevard, which was basically about the same thing. But yeah, it is a riff off of Emma Lazarus. It's about my experience contracting for a certain Labor Department office in upstate New York. I can't say what, but they were having me test out a program that is designed to help the unemployed find work called Internet Job Search, about how to use the internet to find a job. And to most people listening to this, they're probably like, what kind of person actually needs to be told that in the year 2013? And we're talking like, this is in a rural area of New York State that has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state, one of the lowest literacy rates in the state, and most of the people in the program are very uneducated whites who, usually ex-factory workers who worked at, say, a factory, maybe have a if they have a high school degree at most. Most of them don't even have that. They drop out just to go to work, and they work dutifully at this factory or whatever for 20 years, stamping 40, 50 years stamping widgets. And now that it's cheaper to do the manufacturing in Mexico or China or whatever, the factory moves away and leaves them unemployed. And since their pensions are tied up with the factory as well, they don't even get that. They're not bad people. They're just very dumb. And I'm not just saying that to insult them. I'm saying it because it's a fact. And we're expecting people who are in their late 50s, early 60s, who are A, not that smart, and B, at a stage in their life when they are least capable of learning new things, we are expecting to suddenly retool it for the information economy, all for what will basically amount to, they're not even qualified to work at Walmart, because Walmart no longer accepts paper applications, you have to do it online. These people don't know how to use a computer, they don't know how to use email, most of them don't even have email addresses, they don't know how to copy and paste, they don't know how to use a mouse, and it's upsetting. From my perspective, it's upsetting, because you have all these leftists talking about how they care about the poor and whatnot, but they don't give a damn about these people. They call them racist, they call them hillbillies, they call them uneducated. And they are more concerned with helping out foreigners from other countries than they are helping people in their own country who are, I would say, genetically and culturally related to them, which is just, you know, it's a really sad thing.
Well, they're just these kind of like upper class liberals. It's not. I mean, I think they basically have zero compassion for the poor. Everything with them is about what's trendy. Like Darfur is a trendy issue, or gay marriage is a trendy issue, and they're just total dilettantes.
Oh yeah, basically it's like that too. It's like they care. It's about social status printing. Like for example, the whole thing about involving George Zimmerman. The fact that that became a cause. So I mean, I'm not saying it's a good thing that Trayvon Martin died, but they just want to prove about how good and moral and not racist they are. And at the same time, they couldn't give an actual crap about the actual poor who actually need help. It's they've all but given up over to free market capitalism, if not in what they say and how they live their lives. And all they care about, all their leftism boils down to, is crying about the supposed rights of upper middle class white women or minorities or immigrants, and not about actually helping the working class.
And I mean, it's not just poor whites. I mean, illegal immigration has been a disaster for blacks as well.
Oh, yes, exactly. I mean, that's probably the biggest example of how leftism has totally screwed, modern leftists are totally screwing over the working class. As Jim Goad and a few other researchers have found, even going back to the so-called golden age of Ellis Island, capitalists and business owners were in favor of large amounts of immigration, specifically because having more workers in depresses wages and basically increases their power and increases the amount of wealth that's flowing to them. And leftists do not realize that by endorsing open borders and endorsing more immigration, they are hurting the poor people that they purport to care about. Basically, immigration benefits no one. It benefits the immigrants maybe, but it hurts the natives even more. And in a country that is with such high unemployment and underemployment rates, we should not be taking in people. Like we should not be taking even more people in, because it's just going to make the unemployment rate go up and make everyone poorer. But leftists don't see this internal contradiction in how they approach politics.
Yeah, I mean, even Mark Ames is probably like the absolute best of the left, and even in his book, he still doesn't get it.
He and Yasha Levine have become even worse, if you can imagine that. But they don't seem to realize. They don't realize. I mean, they realize how capitalism and how the working man has been screwed. Yet they endorse a policy that will only help them get screwed and will only help the capitalists. I mean, Ames, despite his inveighing against libertarians, has somehow, the fact that every single of the Koch industries funded libertarians such as Brian Kaplan or Megan McArdle or whatever, they're all in favor of open borders. And Ames doesn't step back and think, well, maybe there's a reason for that.
He's sort of the conservative equivalent of him would be a Tea Party supporter who's against illegal immigration but thinks that the Koch brothers are good guys. That's like the equivalent.
Oh yeah. I mean, just things are all topsy turvy, and both the left and the right in this sense are ideologically incoherent. You know, it's like give with one hand, take with the other.
Yeah, I mean, the best thing is, I mean, you're kind of affiliated with the alternative right, but I think it's stupid to just I think it's kind of stupid to use political labels. I think everyone just needs to think for themselves.
Exactly. I mean, I do affiliate with the alternative right and reactionaries and whatnot, but my economic opinions are a bit are I guess would be a bit to the left of that, as some people jokingly accuse me of being a socialist. I'm not a socialist. I'm not a capitalist. I just know what's a side of the Brit. I just know what's good for me, and what isn't good for me is A, bringing in more illegal immigrants and more immigrants period, and B, endorsing the right of the Koch brothers and whatnot to rob the treasury and impoverish us even more.
One thing I want to point out about the Kochs is that one of the reason gas prices are so high is not because of the limited supply of oil. It's actually because they're hogging up large amounts of oil to jack up the prices.
That's true, and I'm very mild defense to them. It's not just them. It's a whole bunch of people doing that. And it was Matt Taibbi went over this in his book Riftopia. The reason he crunched the numbers and discovered that China, the common explanation for the reason for high gas prices is that the Chinese and the Indians are consuming more gas, and therefore we're just going to have to get along with rest because demand has gone up. But Taibbi actually went and crunched the numbers and found out that actual oil usage in China and India has barely budged in the past decade. Realistically, the reason why gas prices are so high is because as you said, oil speculations. People like Koch Industries are buying up huge amounts of oil and then pulling it off the markets to which makes them money, and in this process sends gas prices up. Occasionally, when they'll occasionally go over too far and watch the whole thing crater down, as we saw about around the election of 08 when gas price well. I was living in Albany, New York at the time, and I watched gas prices go from about $3.90 a gallon to around $2.20 a gallon in the span of about 3 weeks. And we're looking, and I wager something like that is going to happen in the near future, as once again the oil speculators bite off more than they can chew.
So we can move on to a totally different subject. This book, I haven't read this book, but it seems very fascinating. It's called NVSQ. VAM Nowhere by Anna Sterzinger.
Yes, I reviewed that recently, and I don't think that's exactly how it's pronounced. The title is it's from the Latin word for nowhere, and I think it's pronounced Nusquam, but I'm not sure. I'll just
Nusquam.
Something like that. It's the Latin word for nowhere, and that sort of gets over what Sterzinger was writing about. It's a it's a tale of, I guess, middle class white male failure, as I would define it. You know, rooted in the tradition of Celine, Edward Limonov, John Dolan, and whatnot. And it's put out by
that's kind of the theme in all of this stuff. The article we just talked about, even the Mark Ames book.
Yes, basically. That seems to be the most strongest undercurrent of literature and politics nowadays. The decline and fall of white men. And
do you know that blogger? There's a Black Manosphere blogger named Obsidian, and he had some article. I mean, he kind of likes to troll white racists, but he had an article. It's kind of interesting, called the plight of the marginal white male.
I would be worried about approaching Obsidian, because he's not he has a point. He's not approaching the argument in good faith, but he does have a point in the sense that in the sense that white men really have been, you know, basically been knocked down more than a few pegs in the last couple of decades, and we are sort of struggling. And yet at the same time,
so you're saying he's kind of has a schadenfreude about it.
I don't know if I'd say schadenfreude, but I'm saying he's not approaching it from the standpoint of someone who is genuinely interested in getting at the facts. He's just doing it to get one over on the white boys. But he does have a point, and this undercurrent does exist. And you have books like Nusquam by Sterzinger that basically confront and explore this idea.
So who's the main character in this book?
The book is about a 40-something white guy, obviously, named Lester Reichardson. I believe that's how it's pronounced. It's something long in German, and it follows him as he is attending graduate school in southern Illinois after being kicked out of a former punk rocker. He had been kicked out of the punk band that he had been in for a decade because he had a disagreement with the bassist and very pathetic. And then his girlfriend gets pregnant and doesn't tell him, and they, at which point they end up getting married and moving down to this really crap hole town in southern Illinois. She becomes a professor. He becomes a student to get his graduate degree in the classics. And it basically just follows about how he is a sort of just completely failed out of everything at life and has absolutely no control over what anything happens to him. It's very dark and very funny and very poignant at the same time.
And you actually compare the author to what you say she's a secular female anti-natalist version of Andy Nowicki.
Yes, Nine Banded Books, the publisher of Starsinger's book, also put out Andy Nowicki's first book, Considering Suicide, and they seem to be friends. I believe they're friends. I talk more to Nowicki than I do to Starsinger, but they're despite coming from two different walks of life. She's a more secular. He is a religious Catholic. Their work is very, very similar in that it approaches white male failure and the existential angst of Generation X. I believe they're both Generation X in their 40s, and basically the Generation X's discontent and just general lack of comfort with the world, along with the decline of white men. And I find that quite interesting as a reader and as a connoisseur of books and novels.
And you kind of you touch on Andy Nowicki has been kind of lately he's been going on a big he wants to kind of start up a big kind of a sex negative movement. What's your take on that?
And my opinion is that I don't agree with him, but, and we have clashed on this in the past before, I don't agree with him, but I understand where he's coming from. And I can understand it in an intellectual sense anyway.
So you're sex positive?
I'd say yes. And I can see, but I don't agree with him. I think his conclusions are wrong, but I can see why he's coming to those conclusions. I can see his thought processes and why he would say. The example I gave in my review of Starsinger's book is that he recently wrote an article about why masturbation is better than fornication, and I believe it ended with something to the effect of you should masturbate instead because at least then your shame is private. And from an intellectual standpoint, I get it. I get why he's talking about this, but at the same time, I don't feel shame. I mean, not to send this into a TMI territory, but it's
that
like
sounds very Catholic.
Yeah, we're just two different people. I'm in my 20s, he's in my 40s, and it's a generational gap that basically will never be traversed. I mean, we can dialogue, but I'll never be in the place that he is, and he'll never be in the place I am. So, but I don't agree with him, but I see where he's coming from.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I was born in 85, so we're probably about the same age. What would you say are some of the trends about this our generation that are different than, say, his?
Well, this has been explored more thoroughly in. Have you read The Fourth Turning?
No, book? I haven't.
It sort of explores all this idea, these ideas, and separates out. There are four different types of generations, and the millennial generation, which is what you and I are. I was born in 1988. We are the hero generation. We tend to approach things from a more can-do and positive and self-sacrificing sort of way, whereas Generation X is, I forget the exact term for it, but they tend to be more pessimistic and more world-weary. And the reason for this relating to Generation X is because I've written this about this before. They were born with one foot in the old world and one foot in the new. They were born and came of age roughly, in America anyway, roughly the time that traditional America was coming apart in the 60s. They witnessed the final death throes of traditionalist America and the rise of the new leftist America in the 60s and 70s. And this left a huge psychological impact on them.
Yeah,
and you can see it.
We grew up in a society that was already basically totally rotten.
Yeah, so we don't have that firsthand experience of what what an ideal society looks like. Whereas Gen X saw that society taken away from them, and it's given them, I guess, a certain amount of angst. And you can see this shot through in pretty much any and all Gen X art and literature. Whether we're talking about someone like Mark Ames, who is sort of rudderless hedonism, Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, the angst, hardcore punk, the Dead Kennedys, and whatnot, and it reflects a completely different temperament from what you and I have, who I'd say are more, we have a more can-do attitude. And as Naoki pointed out in his article, the manosphere, which tends to be 20s and guys in their early 30s, tend to approach things with a bit more, I'd say, positivity.
talking about like someone like Royce?
Not necessarily Royce, but guys like Roosh and myself and Jack Donovan, to a lesser extent, approach things from a can-do attitude. Whereas we don't have that lingering pessimism that Generation X has.
But I mean, someone like Roosh, he's just kind of like he's just like a hedonist.
He is a hedonist in many ways, but he's also a man focused on self-improvement. I mean, comparing what he was doing a decade ago to what he's doing now, he's boosting classic literature. He's writing these fantastic short stories, and he's generally focused on self-improvement and whatnot. And the overall thrust of the manosphere is in that direction. Versus,
as opposed to just complaining.
Yes, and it represents the difference between the millennials and the Generation X. And X condition. I'm not saying it's. I'm not putting a moral judgment on this. I'm just saying this is how things are.
You reviewed Andy Nowicki's Heart Killer.
I reviewed all of his books so far. Yes.
So what was? I haven't read that one yet. What is your take on it?
Oh, it's a very good. It's a very good book, and it's easily his best work to date. He was obviously influenced by his dealings with the Manosphere, which the plot is about a. It's about a nerdy kid who, growing up in the 80s, who, when he grows up, he becomes a pickup artist, and he starts cruelly seducing women, and at one point, he is inexplicably knocked back 20 years in time, so that he is back to when he was 16 again, and generally tries to write things, as it were, and while Nowicki is clearly against the more hedonistic or sex-positive aspects of the Manosphere, he, in
yeah,
a sense,
identifies with the character.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I'd say he much the same way. I understand where he's coming from, even though I don't agree with it. He understands where we're coming from, but he doesn't agree with it. And his characterization in the Heart Killer reflects that. It's the book is largely narrated through the experiences of a FBI criminal profiler who is investigating the "quote unquote" Heart Killer at the school, and. Nowicki's characterization is such that a lot of these characters are depraved, obviously, but they're not irredeemable. They're not monsters. Even the most wretched character has a shining moment, and to a certain extent,
it's not like American Psycho per se.
No, he utilizes shock value for making a greater point. He doesn't do shock for shock's sake, and all
this
characters do.
Some of the stuff in I haven't read Heart Killer. I read Columbine Pilgrim. There's two things in it that are shocking. There's this thing about Hitler and Nietzsche crucified together in a swastika 69 position, and then there's another part where in the end where he urinates on the face of one of the guys he's going to kill.
Yes, it is shocking, but again. We are depicted about how Tony Mander, the protagonist of the Columbine Pilgrim, became that way. He's not a heartless killer, but he was bullied, and it turned him into a monster. He became a monster because the way he was treated when he was a teenager. I mean, and to a certain extent, again, we get that redemption in the end with the ending. I don't know if I want to spoil it for those of your listeners who haven't read it, but it is kind of chilling. And Heart Killer takes that idea and moves it to the next level.
So, before I wrap the show up, is there anything else you'd like to add about any one of these topics?
Not at the moment. Not that I can think of.
All right. So, Matt, thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, Robert.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.